Hello and welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Dave.
And I'm Annie. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
This month, Dave's choice was Dr. Strangelove.
Wow.
1964 Stanley Kubrick film that I've been avoiding watching for about 40 years. Well, not that I would have wanted to watch it when I was six, but still.
I mean, at some point in time, we ask how many stars you give this, but you were sighing before you read out the title. I don't think that's ever happened before, or even on the things that we've given really awful marks to.
Why did you pick it?
It's very different to things we've been doing recently, I think. It's incredibly iconic, it's massively multi-award winning, it's extremely historically important film, and, ooh, you're having a face. And
I'm just baffled. You can regale me with why all of those things are true.
Yes. And, you know, recently we were doing what we thought was going to be, you know, a light conversation about a dance film that turned into problematic tropes of racial depictions on film. And so I thought, why not escalate to nuclear war?
Fair enough.
So, you know, what did you think, dare I even ask?
I mean, it wasn't as bad as I was expecting, I have to say. I'll give it that. How about you? Did it hold up for you?
Is that
it? I mean,
it?
Did you love it? I mean, how many times have you seen it before? Why would you have watched it in the past?
How many times have I seen it before? Maybe three? Two or three, maybe?
Why?
Because it is incredibly iconically powerful, and because there are bits of it, fewer bits than I remembered, but there are bits of it that are very, very funny.
Okay. Again, you'll have to regale me, because...
Okay.
I.
So, how about a brief plot synopsis?
For anybody who's lucky enough not to have seen it.
Really? This is how it is it? I see.
A rogue US Air Force general sends instructions for planes to drop nuclear bombs on Russia without authorization. The president and all his advisors convene at the Pentagon to try and sort it out, but one plane gets through... Presumably, I'm assuming, setting off the Russian doomsday device that they're also worried about and ending the world?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay. Yeah. It wasn't entirely clear.
So the important thing to point out...
Many, many things about this film were not entirely clear to me.
Two important things to point out at the start. First of all, that sounds like a full-on drama. Now, this is not... A standard comedy film?
No.
It is a, I guess, a satire?
Sure.
I mean, what is Monty Python? Monty Python is a particular style of...
Absurdist.
That's the kind of thing I'm after. It's a kind of absurdist. You're not supposed to take the situation seriously, even though it is one of the most important situations that could ever exist. Mm. And the point was that they make you, through the tropes of it being completely ridiculous, it makes you take the whole notion of nuclear weapons as being equally absurd.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I thought that it was actually quite an interesting thought experiment, which I guess is why there was the disclaimer on the front that the US Air Force had assured the world that this could never happen, so that people wouldn't worry that it could happen.
So that's the first thing I was going to say. The other thing, which is really interesting, that I didn't realise until I was starting to take notes while I was watching it, is that the film is called Dr. Strangelove, and the character of Dr. Strangelove is barely in it.
Yeah, he's in it for about 2 minutes, just over halfway through, and then for a completely incomprehensible section of about 4 minutes right at the end.
Yeah, so we'll come to this, but the first bit when he's in it is only so that when he turns up at the end, you have any idea who he is.
I guess.
Because otherwise, it'd be like, wow, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
And the bit at
It
the
was quite
end,
weird.
and you're obviously not going to agree with me here, but the bit at the end is one of the best pieces of comedy ever filmed.
But it makes no sense and it's wildly offensive.
Well, we'll get to that. But
Weirdly.
it is an absolute masterpiece of like 3 minutes of completely over the top comedy, and they have to put it in right at the end because it's so ridiculously over the top, you couldn't come back from it and carry on making the film sensible in any way.
Okay. Weirdly, I didn't think that Peter Sellers was actually in it that much because I didn't realize that he had played the president as well as Mandrake and Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
And I only just discovered that 5 minutes ago on Wikipedia, so
Okay.
that helps me understand it a bit more. And the other thing that helps me understand it a bit more in terms of its complete incomprehensibility in places was that Sellers apparently ad-libbed most of his lines, which is why none of it makes sense.
So, yes. So Peter Sellers was well known for being really difficult to work with, not because he was an unpleasant guy, but because he would just wildly deviate off from whatever script that he was given. And so it just made him, in all the things that he was in, quite
Yeah.
difficult to do. But because he was a comic genius, he got away with a heck of a lot, and he was very popular.
Well, it was interesting because he plays three parts. He plays a British Air Force soldier who's on the base where the general has gone rogue and has sent these instructions. And that character I actually quite liked. And he actually, well,
Well,
he almost saves the world, but doesn't quite.
we're kind of getting a bit out of order.
Oh,
Should
I'm sorry, yes.
we do?
We should do facts.
We should do
Let's do
facts, if that's
facts.
okay.
Of course.
Do you want to dig in? Because I've got a lot of stuff.
Well, as I say, I've done most of mine already. The only other thing was that I found it quite amusing that it was filmed at Shepperton because Sellers was going through a divorce at the time and couldn't leave England.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest, but I didn't know that. So let me regale you with my long list of facts while you attempt not
Go for it.
to, you know, fall asleep.
Somebody's got to find something to say about this movie.
So it came out in 1964.
Yeah. Which, like, deep in the Cold War.
Yeah. So to give you
2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
to give you an idea of things that are out at the same time, 1964, Mary Poppins,
Okay.
My Fair Lady, Goldfinger.
Okay.
So we've got some escapism, we've got a bit of spy stuff going on, and then at the same time, there's a film called Failsafe, and I should have written down who was in it, I can't remember, but it is essentially a very similar plot to this, but taken absolutely incredibly deadly seriously.
Oh, okay.
It's about, you know, the brink of nuclear war because things go terribly wrong.
Okay.
There's
Interesting.
also another film that comes out this year, which I didn't even write the name down for, never mind the people who are in it, which is about a group of people in the, I think the CIA, who decide that America's been infiltrated by communists at the highest level and decide they're going to assassinate a bunch of senior American politicians and generals and stuff because they believe they're all communists
Okay.
until they're stuck. So on the one hand, you've got escapism stuff like Mary Poppins. On the other hand, you've got, you know, we're all gonna die because the bomb's gonna go off any minute, incredibly seriously. And then you've got this kind of sitting in the middle,
Yeah.
being this really weird hybrid of the two sorts of things that are going on. So I
Yeah.
just find that super interesting. So it's directed by Stanley Kubrick
Yeah, which
of
I hadn't. I mean, I probably did know, but I hadn't thought about.
2001, Clockwork Orange.
Eyes Wide Shut.
I want to say The Shining?
Yes.
So, yeah. There's his. What's the word I can't say?
Not my thing.
Oeuvre?
Oeuvre.
Oeuvre is not your thing.
Not
Oh.
my thing. I'm pretty sure I don't like any of his films
Oh.
that I've seen and that I've heard of.
Okay.
That I'm aware of.
I mean, 2001 is amazing. The Shining is very good, but I didn't enjoy it. I found Eyes Wide Shut really boring.
You've watched it?
I believe so.
Okay.
I found it really dull.
Yes, I mean, I've never watched The Shining. I don't think I would enjoy it. I've not enjoyed bits of it that I've seen. But his stuff is weirdly boring.
Have you seen 2001?
Yeah.
Oh, damn it.
I'm not watching that again.
You watched Solaris.
Solaris is amazing. Well, no, I mean, not the original. I like the remake. People are going to... Yeah. Like the remake.
I mean, you can force me to watch that if you like. I haven't seen it.
Oh, I've already done when I was still doing the in-between episodes. Oh, yes, of course. I did all of the versions of Solaris, the book, both the movies, and I went to a stage version of it, and it was quite the experience.
Okay. Anyway, sorry for the massive deviation. Yeah. Directed and mostly written by Stanley Kubrick, with a couple of other writers, one of whom is a chap called Peter George, who wrote a novel called Red Alert that this film is based on. Okay. I believe that Red Alert is not a comedy.
Right.
It is a serious version of terrible things that could happen that could lead up to nuclear war, and that this was taken and turned into a comedy by Stanley Kubrick. As you say, Peter Sellers plays multiple characters, improvised a lot.
He was meant to play the commanding officer on the plane that gets through as well, but
okay.
He was worried he wouldn't be able to do a Texan accent and that he would also be working way too hard.
Mm-hmm.
They persuaded him to give it a try, but then he sprained his ankle, and apparently that meant he couldn't work on the cramped set of the plane.
Okay.
So they got someone else to do it instead.
That's interesting, because it also explains why all the other characters don't move around very much. Because the president basically sits still and never gets up for the entire...
Yeah, I mean, Mandrake does a little bit of running around.
A little tiny bit, yes. Anyway.
But he does say he has a gammy leg.
Well, yes. So, it also stars George C. Scott, who is a quite famous actor at the time, known for doing sort of dramatic bad guy type of roles. I believe he's the general who wants to go through and do the war with all the chewing gum.
Yeah.
And Slim Pickens. And Slim Pickens is famous for doing westerns.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, he plays the pilot of the nuclear bomber that ends up dropping the bomb at the end. And it was wildly out of kilter for the normal role that he played. And he apparently loved it.
Mm. Well, he must have been brought in at quite short notice, because that was the other part that Sellers was meant to play.
Yeah, so... Yes, it was unusual for him, but he was very well regarded in it and apparently really enjoyed doing it. It was very popular when it came out. It made a lot of money.
Okay.
And packed the cinemas out. And let me give you, I'm afraid, I'm going to give you the long list of all of the... accolades. That's the word I'm after. So... The American Film Institute put it in its list of films considered best of all time. The United States Library of Congress added it as one of the first 25 films selected for preservation in the National Film Registry. It received 4 Academy Award nominations, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Actors for Sellers, but didn't win the. It was nominated for 7 BAFTAs, winning Best Film and Best Art Direction. It won the Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. It's on Roger Ebert's list of greatest movies of all time. He stated it was the best political satire of the century. And polls of readers of various things, Total Film, when polled, it came the 24th greatest comedy film of all time. Time Out, 47th greatest film of all time. Entertainment Weekly, 14th greatest film of all time. And the Writers Guild of America said it's the 12th best screenplay of any film ever written.
Okay, well, you know, there are plenty of films that people think are amazing in general that I don't like. But, you know...
Fair.
I thought it was boring at the start and incomprehensible at the end and wildly offensive at various points in the middle. And
I'm interested about the wildly offensive bits. I'm sure we'll get to that. So as you say, it starts with a cold open. It has text scrolling up the screen saying that the United States Air Force say this can't possibly happen. possibly through the Board of Cinema Classifications saying that you can't put it out unless you put this thing on the front, or possibly because the people who made the film genuinely wanted people to not go home feeling terrified.
Maybe.
So it's very difficult to say. But yes, then, as you say, we have things happening in essentially three different places in the film. We have the Air Force Base, where the commander has essentially gone insane and has sent the nuclear bombers off to go and attack Russia.
He thinks Russia is polluting everybody's bodily fluids in some way.
His precious bodily fluids.
Impotent.
Through fluoridization. That's one interpretation.
Okay.
But, I mean, I hadn't considered that as an interpretation, but yes, that's certainly an interpretation. Yes, he's got this obsession with precious bodily fluids. He only drinks rainwater and grain alcohol. He sends the base off. He makes sure that the encryption codes that are used to talk to those aeroplanes are set up in a code that only he knows. And then he locks
down everything so that nobody else can communicate with the planes.
Yeah, so he
and nobody can get into the base.
Yeah, so he cuts off all the telephone lines and makes sure that nobody in the base has a radio, tells the people on the base that if other people turn up in American Army uniforms that they are Russians who have invaded the country and have dressed up as Americans to look like people on the same side. So you've got that. You've got Peter Sellers playing his British second-in-command who's been seconded to go and help run the base over there. And
I liked him.
He's a very good character. I feel very sorry for him because
absolutely.
He fails to stop the world from being destroyed.
He almost manages to save the world because he does figure out what the code is.
Yes.
And after the general shoots himself in the head, Mandrake...
Off screen.
Mandrake figures out what the code is and sends it through so that nearly all of the planes get recalled, but one of them has been damaged and doesn't get the message.
Yeah.
But I think what was interesting was that as Mandrake, Sellers had to almost play the straight man because the general was so completely off kilter that if he'd been being stupid, it wouldn't have worked.
But the important thing to mention for people who haven't seen it is the general is being insane, but he's being insane and extremely, I want to say, like, laconic?
Kind of logical fashion.
A logical...
To him.
Very calm.
Yeah.
Very calm, almost kind of
because everything
reserved.
He's saying and doing is so outrageous in terms of the consequences and the motivation behind it.
Yeah. I mean, the things that he is saying are so obviously insane, but the way that he puts it over is very, I don't know, that's a calm again.
Reasonable.
Yeah. You know, he's not being.
But even so,
weird
if Sellers had been ad-libbing
nonsense, it wouldn't have
worked.
Yeah.
So he almost had to play a straight dramatic part against that.
Yes. So.
So I quite liked him.
Yeah. So the interesting things that I've got about him is that character's obviously is quite posh. He was a Second World War pilot. We learned that he was captured and tortured by the Japanese and forced to work on the Japanese railway. And what was the other thing I had written down against Mandrake? Oh, he has a sort of post-World War II phenomenal dramatic way of speaking an understatement. It seems that we are a little bit of a pickle when you know, the world is just about to end.
He's very painfully British in amongst all of these Americans.
Yes. It's interesting because I thought while watching the film, obviously incorrectly, that it was a British Air Force base. Because, of course, we had...
To begin with, because he was the first character in.
Yeah, and of course we had nuclear weapons here for a long time. There's a proposal that I don't think will happen, but there's a proposal that they're going to re-put nuclear weapons back into the UK again.
Wow.
We've got Trident, but they're going to, as in the Americans, are going to put bombers back in. But we'll see. So that's going on. I thought the attack by... So the American president says, I need to go and talk to the general, and he's told that all of the communications have been cut off. And then one of the other generals, this is the Air Force, So one of the other generals from the army says, my guys can go in and take over the base, no problem whatsoever. And he has a, you know, bit of a to and fro with the senior Air Force guy, who we'll come to in a minute. And then they send the army guys in, and all the scenes of the fighting I thought were incredibly well made. I thought that the combat scenes have obviously taken a lot of time and effort and money, making those look really realistic.
Yeah.
Which is just out of kilter with the rest of the film being, I don't want to use this word, but, you know, kind of wacky. And just having this combat stuff in the middle is odd, but it was really interesting. And you've got...
Yeah, and it's also quite horrifying because there's you know, American soldiers on both sides killing each other because they think the other side have gone rogue or are the enemy. Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely.
Which isn't true.
Yeah. So General Ripper, who's the guy who's gone insane, has got a massive machine gun, and he is trying to shoot people who are trying to get into the base from his office. And Mandrake is trying to tell him that he believes what he's saying because he wants Ripper to trust him and give him the code.
Mm.
So Mandrake is trying to persuade him that he's on his side. And you get a lot of real close-ups of the guy who plays Ripper right in his face, especially when he's smoking his cigars, lit up from underneath.
Mm.
And it makes him look, you know, properly crazy. And eventually, but this is a bit out of order for the things, but eventually... you get a bit where Ripper's gone into the bathroom and shot himself to make sure no one gets the code. But then the army does manage to take the base, and Mandrake works out what the code is, because it's OPE for our precious essence or something like that. And he needs to tell the president, and then there's a weird, relatively long scene where Mandrake is trying to call the White House to tell them what the code is.
Yeah, and he's doing it in a payphone.
He's doing it
and doesn't have enough change.
He tries to reverse the number and, you know, all that. There's this whole bit where, you know, Mandrake's increasingly, you know, oh my God, there's only like, you know, 10 minutes till the bombers are going to be dropping nuclear weapons and the whole world's going to end. And eventually he manages to get through and tell the president, and it still doesn't work.
Yes, it was weird because it cut immediately from Mandrake getting enough money to make the call to the code having been transmitted to the planes and them all turning around and everybody in the Pentagon cheering and clapping. And I was like, wow, that was, after all that build-up, that was so fast. And we didn't even have any of that happen on screen. It flipped.
But all
and then, of course... the climax is completely different.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. The bit in the middle doesn't matter. So the point I'm getting at is that all of that's like one film unit, if you like, was filming that.
On the base,
And then you've got the second film unit, which is in the war room in the Pentagon. And the war room is absolutely iconic set design. You see stuff like that all the time now. But they did it first.
Okay.
With the giant boards on the screens and the lights and when things are moving around and the big round table with the sort of halo light that's over the top and the way that that's all put together, that was all done first for this. So the set design is just chef's kiss. It's so good. And then you've got the president, who is absolutely unnaturally calm given that the world is ending.
Well, he seems... actually incredibly weak to
me. Yeah, I mean... I could agree with that. So he's doing that. There's some comedy bits where he phones the Russian president and the Russian president... You don't actually ever hear what the Russian president says. You only hear the American president's end, but the Russian president is drunk and he's trying to tell him what the situation is. And he says, you know... we're trying to recall the bombers, but if we fail, we'll tell you exactly what all their flight plans are so you can set your anti-aircraft to go and shoot them all down. What happens in the film... I'm not sure if it's the one I mentioned earlier, Failsafe, the one where they take it really seriously, or another... because there was a whole spate of these sort of films coming out in the 60s. Might have been Failsafe. I read a whole bunch of ones on Wikipedia around the same time. It might be a different one. But there was one where they realised that for one reason or another they weren't going to be able to stop a rogue something or other blowing up a Russian city. And so they preemptively nuke New York. So the Americans blow up New York so that they can say, you know, yes, we destroyed, I don't know, Leningrad or whatever, but, you know, we also did this to counterbalance it, and therefore please don't set off the full whatever.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it makes no sense, but this is the kind of fuss people were making at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you've got all the stuff that's going on in the war room. In the war room, you've got the president. You've got General Turgeson, who is a somewhat comedic character who chews and pops a lot of chewing gum and is very much, well, now that the bombers are on the way, surely the right thing to do is to follow it up by sending all the bombers, because, you know, we've got no choice now. We've mapped it out. We can definitely win this war with no more than 20 million casualties, and that's perfectly reasonable to destroy all the commies.
Mm.
He has a girlfriend who phones him in the war room.
Yes, we'll get to Miss Scott later.
She's barely in it. He does do quite an impressive slapstick trip over and fall on something at one point in time.
For no apparent reason. For no, it doesn't go anywhere or no, do anything.
I wonder if he actually genuinely tripped over in the, middle of the filming. But yeah, he's one of the other people in the war room. You've then got the Russian ambassador, who's a bit of a cliche. But the reason for him being there is to describe the doomsday device.
Yeah.
And the Russians have built this device, which basically can tell if a nuclear weapon's been set off anywhere, and if it does, will set off nuclear weapons that they've hidden all over the world that will coat the world in cobalt thorium G, which I have no idea is a real thing or not, which apparently makes the surface of the Earth uninhabitable. It's interesting that at this point they were saying that the world would be destroyed by covering it in a lot of nuclear fallout. And that's the sort of stuff you see from, you know, Philip K. Dick or from On the Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a book and a film that I have read the plot synopsis of and would pay very good money to never have to see the film, because it feels like the most depressing thing ever. Don't look it up. But whereas reality, of course, is it's not the amount of fallout, it's the nuclear winter that gets you. But where was my point before I went wildly off target? Russian ambassador. The Russian ambassador is there to describe the doomsday device. And there's a lot of discussion in the real world at the time about having a missile gap. You know, the Russians have more missiles than we do, so we should therefore have more missiles, or, you know, a bomber gap, you know, this type of stuff. And so they talk in this about having, you know, various, you know, gaps that we don't have the same number of things as the Russians. And Turgeson makes a point of saying, oh, that doomsday device sounds brilliant. Why don't we have one of those as well? And it's like, don't need more than one. So yes, that's the also in the war room is Dr. Strangelove, and Dr. Strangelove was a Nazi scientist, and he's been, like Werner von Braun and a lot of other people, was brought over in presumably Operation Paperclip and made a scientific advisor to the Americans. And he is a wildly over the top guy in a wheelchair who has a comedy right arm that he doesn't have any real control over and will do Hitler salutes and try to strangle him, and, you know, is just, ooh, your face, is just wildly over the top.
Yeah.
And as we said earlier, he's only in it very briefly to...
Yeah. It was so bizarre because the film is named after him, and then, you know, he doesn't turn up until over halfway through, and then for only 2 minutes, and then there's this whole section at the end which needs its own discussion.
Yes, we'll come to that. But yeah, he gets his 2 minutes. I can't even remember what the early 2 minutes is talking about.
The president is asking him if the doomsday device can be real.
Yes, and he goes through that, and we'll come to the bit at the end. But so these are the first two parts, and then the third part is on the plane.
Which I also didn't hate, because those guys seemed quite cool.
So one of the things that, if you start to pay more attention than I would normally do to, you know, anything, that you notice is that there's a single bomber wing come from America to go and attack the Soviet Union. And when you look at the map of the Soviet Union, you've got lines of lights that represent the where the planes are and where they're going, and they're coming from every direction.
Yeah.
Well, if you're a bomber wing, you wouldn't be able to fly into every direction in Russia because you can't be up that long.
Well, it said at the beginning that although, the planes were up 24 hours a day constantly.
Yeah.
So to be ready. So I assumed that they were all meant to be 2 hours away from their targets. So
yeah,
they're kind of like circling Russia.
It's
and
also
presumably at some point others have to come and relieve them and then they go home.
Yeah, but I mean a wing tends
to... Which makes
to,
no sense.
Yeah, I mean a wing tends to mean a group of planes that are all in the same area go the same way, I would have thought.
Well, yes, but these were
but
all
anyway,
like individuals that
yeah.
just seem to be hanging around.
I mean, the other thing, I mean, you know,
it doesn't make any sense.
I mean, to their credit, after the bit at the start of the film with the text scrolling up the screen saying that, you know, the American Air Force says this can't happen, directly after that, there's a musical introduction while they show a whole bunch of mid-air refueling. So they do actually
mm-hmm.
do that.
But they would also have to somehow change the crews because they couldn't be there
the
time.
It's interesting, there was a premise to have a nuclear powered airplane that would basically never land.
Okay.
And you could have some kind of method for changing people on the plane, but it would never come down. The I don't think they ever actually built one. They had all sorts of weird plans for things they might build in the Cold War. So on the plane is Slim Pickens is the pilot who talks in Southern cliched, I was going to say homilies, but you know, phrases. And you've got a bunch of other people on the plane. You've got the bombardier and the co-pilot and a bunch of other people.
Communication,
guy. Yeah. And they are very surprised to get a genuine order to go and attack somewhere, and they think that it's going to be some kind of loyalty test, that they're going to fly to a certain point and then be told to come back, because as you see in things like War Games, which is a very good film that I would strongly recommend, which is it's a YA film, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
About hackers, well, about a hacker accidentally almost setting off World War III. And at the start of that, you've got some people in a missile base, and they're given an order to fire the missiles, and the guy doesn't turn the key. And the plot is that, you know, that is then replaced by a connection to the big central computer, and when the central computer gets hacked, it almost starts World War III. But there was a large percentage of people in American missile bases who, when they were run through those drills, didn't turn the key. I can't remember what the number is, but it's like 25%, something like that. And so they're very surprised in the airplane when they're given a thing and they don't think it's real. And then when they get past the line where they're likely to get detected by Russian radar and they realize it is real, they start, you know, being very serious about it. But because Russian air defenses know where they are, there's a missile fired at them. And the missile doesn't hit them, but it goes off nearby and it destroys, first of all, their communications device. So even when Mandrake gets the right code, they still can't communicate with them. But also it gives them a major fuel leak, so they can't head to where they're supposed to. So they pick another target from the book of targets that they've got, which means that when the Americans have told the Russians where the planes are going in order to get them shot down, it's not going there anymore. It still really should have been found on the radar, but they made a whole thing of the fact they're flying very low and very fast, and there were a lot of shots of the airplane flying very low and very fast, and it's early days for special effects, so it's not great, but you certainly get the idea that they're flying under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
But what they discover as they get close to the place they decide they're going to bomb is the bomb bay doors won't open because the missile's broken something. And so Slim Pickens goes down to go and fix the bomb bay doors and climbs on top of one of the nuclear missiles. And the two nuclear missiles have two things on them. The first thing they have is a sign saying nuclear warhead handled with care, which I thought was quite amusing. And then they have graffiti on them. One of them says, Dear John, I'll come up with what the other one says. No. Anyway, but anyway, he gets on top of the. You know, this is the biggest spoiler for the film, but he gets on top of the missile, and as they get to the place where the bomb is supposed to be dropped, he's working on the wiring of the Bombay doors to try and make it work. And then he manages to get the doors open, and then they drop the bomb while he's sitting on it, and then it falls with him riding it like a rodeo, essentially.
Mm.
And Slim Pickens was basically known for doing rodeo riding characters in westerns. that's what his thing, yeah, that he was known for. And then he rides the missile down, and that's probably one of the, I would say it's one of the top 10 most iconic shots in the whole of cinema.
Yeah, I could see that.
And then the bomb goes off, and then we have the weird bit with Dr. Strangelove that we'll talk about in a bit. And then you have a montage at the end of lots and lots of nuclear bomb tests back to back, which is supposed to be showing the Russian bombs going off and, yep, and ending the world. Before we go and talk about the Dr. Strangelove bit, I've talked a lot. But before we go and talk about...
I have a lot to say about Dr. Strangelove's speech at the end and Miss Scott.
Okay, so before we... Is she the only female character?
Yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll come to that in a minute. But before we go and touch on the Dr. Strangelove bit, I want to briefly touch on the music, if that's okay.
Yes, I was very confused as to why they kept playing as a refrain, "The animals came out two by two, hurrah, hurrah."
So,
is that also the music for something else?
Not that I'm aware of. So there's three...
So why are they doing a kid's Noah's Ark song throughout the movie?
So there's three or four things I want to say about the music. The first one is that the introduction music is almost like... I'm trying to think of a good analogy, like, you know, Desert Island Discs. It was it's very, you know...
Yeah, very lyrical.
Very lyrical.
Sort of elevator
type. Yeah, kind of...
Classical music.
You know, isn't it lovely and pleasant while we're watching these films doing refueling and then, you know, horrible things happen?
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end, while all the bombs are going off, they're playing We'll Meet Again.
Yeah.
Which is just, again, you know... Chef's kiss, just perfect. The other thing that's really interesting about the music is there's hardly any.
Mm.
There's the start music, there's the end music, there's the thing which you picked up, which I'll talk about in a second, but there isn't any, these are the emotions you're supposed to be feeling because we're feeding it to you via the music that you get, yeah, basically constantly in almost every film that has come out in the last, like, 40 years.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
Is lining your emotions up for you in real, mm-hmm, time, all the time. And most of it, it's silent. It's almost like a play.
Yeah.
You know, you could put... I wonder... Yeah, I'm just thinking about whether you could do this as a stage play. You could probably do this quite well as a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, The Animals Going 2x2 is... I don't know. For me, it's partly... It's a kind of... Because of the drum beat and the way it's put together, partly it's kind of to do with, like, inevitability.
Right.
And partly it's to do with not thinking.
Okay.
You're lined up 2x2 and you go off and do the thing that you've
been told to do. Yeah, that makes sense.
That, you know, it's about regimentation and doing stuff without thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that's why I think they picked it. I've talked for a long time without a break. Do you want to say your whole piece about Strangelove? And I will try and chip in.
So, at the end of the film, they have sent the code to recall the bombers. One of the bombers has still got through. And before that missile gets dropped and essentially sets off the doomsday device that ends the world, Dr. Strangelove gives this weird... rambling speech about how they could survive by living underground and then come up after 100 years when the fallout has disappeared and retake over the world. And it makes no sense because they've got like 3 minutes. How is he going to do this in three minutes?
It says, if you listen to his speech, he says that the surface of the Earth won't reach lethal radioactivity levels for 10 months.
Oh, okay.
That's part of it.
I have a terrible, terrible confession to make.
So, can I tell you a thing?
I may have missed some nuance and some details because I watched the second 2/3 of the film on double speed, which made it much more amusing. I have to say, it made it much more amusing.
Oh.
But it is possible that I may have missed a few details. Okay, so fair enough.
Human being.
In my defense, that I missed the whole 10 month thing, I don't think you'd be able to put all of this together and actually have it work inside 10 months anyway.
Yeah, the problem with these kind of things is that it doesn't take much to break. You can say, oh, you can have, you know, nuclear reactors for power and hydroponics for food and, you know, all this kind of stuff, but when your nuclear reactor breaks and you can't make a replacement part, well, that's it.
Yeah.
You know,
so it's never going to work.
Mm.
Yes, and he also says that in order to be able to repopulate the world afterwards, you'd have to have 10 women for every man and give up the societal conventions of relationships and also select the women for sexual attractiveness.
Yes.
And so he needs to be set on fire.
Yes, but it's all on purpose.
What do you mean?
He's supposed to be a terrible human being.
Yeah, but they're all agreeing with him.
They're all supposed to be terrible human beings.
Yeah, but so. You know, I didn't find it funny, I'm sorry.
It's funny because it's abhorrent.
Okay.
In context.
If you say so. And he's also fighting with his arm and shifting around in his chair and calling the president Mein Führer and then randomly getting up and...
Oh, the people who know me, especially you, will know that the very last line of the film, which is when Dr. Strangelove, overcome with the emotion of the situation of building, you know, this mineshaft in which, as he says, you know, of course, the most important military and political leaders and scientists will get to go into this mineshaft with all these incredibly attractive young women. And having, you know, been somewhat possessed with an energy by this idea, he stands up from his wheelchair and takes a couple of steps forward and then goes, Mein Führer, I can walk! And then it cuts to black. And
you told me he immediately fell down and then he doesn't.
Did I?
Yes, I was looking forward to it, the whole thing.
Oh.
That was the only thing I was looking forward to, was seeing him fall on his face, and then it didn't happen.
I don't remember telling you that, sorry. But yes, there are bits when, in my dotage, you know, I've had a particularly stiff-legged day and I managed to climb out of a chair and take a couple of steps and I'm like, Mein Führer, I can walk! And this is where it comes from.
Uh-huh.
But, as I said earlier on, the whole bit at the end only works because it's at the end, because it's so ridiculous and over the top you wouldn't be able to do anything else that's after it. And it is cinematographically, bleh, that's a great word, it is, the way it's shot is perfect and it's an absolute masterclass in physical humour, but it has to be very short and it has to be right at the end, because otherwise it just wouldn't work.
Okay. Do you have anything else?
That is a very interesting question. I thought it... Normally we talk about diversity. We will come to that in a minute. I've got a couple of points to say on that. Don't think so.
Okay. There is one, count them, one female character in the entire film.
She's in her underwear.
She gets one scene in which she is in General Turgidson's house, I assume, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and she is on a tanning bed in a bikini and stilettos, and she is meant to be his secretary, but clearly there is more to it than that. And she answers the phone and then acts as Sigourney Weaver in Galaxy Quest because the general is in the toilet, relaying all of the information from the guy on the phone shouted to the general in the toilet, and that is basically all she does, and that's it.
She does phone him in the war room.
And then she phones him in the war room. We don't hear her side of the conversation,
yes.
But she's apparently calling him to find out if their relationship is purely physical and if
yes.
he really loves her.
Yes.
And yes, I wanted to burn the world.
And he says, don't worry, go to sleep, I'll be back soon. And then he says, oh, before you go to sleep, remember to say your prayers.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're probably going to get blown up.
Yes. So that was it.
I mean, in its totally non-existent defence, A, it's 1964.
Yes.
And B, in a film that's all about the military, you just aren't going to get any women in
1964. Oh, sure. Yeah.
So, yes, but I do see your point.
She was very kind of Bond babe.
Oh, yeah. Couple of other brief diversity bits?
Yes. If I hadn't seen James Earl Jones's name in the credits.
That is not James Earl Jones.
If I hadn't seen James Earl Jones's name in the credits, I would have written down, this film is 100% white. Because I was looking out for him specifically, and he got maybe two lines and one close-up shot where I went, oh yes, that's him, but I would not have spotted him if I hadn't been looking out for him. He was one of the guys on the plane.
Is that really James Earl Jones?
It was James Earl Jones. When I heard him speak, I was like, yes, I can hear. He was a very, very young James Earl Jones.
Super young.
And he got maybe one close-up shot and a couple of lines where I was like, oh yes, that's him, only because I was looking out for him because I saw his name in the credits, and that was it.
I have extreme possibility of getting cancelled for saying this, but, you know, he's got a fro.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, looking good.
Wow. But what was I going to say? No, because there's one non-white character. I think all of the... There's a lot of actors in the war room who just sit round the table.
Yeah, for the entire film.
For the entire film. And doing don't nothing. Do yeah. nothing and say nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's not that many speaking parts.
Are there non-white characters in the war room?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. So what were you going to say?
My point was there's no non-white characters in the war room, but the guy on the plane is made obvious because at the point when the people on the plane realise that it's not a drill, Slim Pickens, as the pilot, has a little speech.
Yeah.
And he says, I never thought I'd have to give this kind of speech, but it's the obvious that the plan that we've been given, the only reason why it would happen is because our control centres and Washington DC have already been destroyed, and, you know, we have to do our absolute best to knock out as much as we can to save more of our people. And he's, you know, got this proper serious speech. And he says, wherever you come from, the people on this plane, wherever you come from, whatever race you are, it's important that we all stand together now as one group that go off and do
stuff. No, he says everybody on this plane will get a medal.
He says that as well.
Regardless of your race, colour or creed, is what he actually says.
Oh, something like that, yes.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, there's a black guy in the plane. And when you say he only gets a couple of lines, that's probably true. But the whole bit at the end where they are coming up to the target, he's presumably the bombardier because it cuts him over and over and over again while they're targeting him. So he gets a lot of
he gets
a concentrated amount of screen time as an important part of the film.
Okay.
So the other thing
to mention
is, and under the diversity stuff, is what's his name? Ripper, the guy who's in charge of the Air Force Base who goes insane, and the portrayal of his
psychosis.
Which in a film that's...
Strong argument for better mental health screening and support for military officers.
So, I knew somebody. I didn't know them very well. I only met them two or three times. Because they were... I knew them through somebody else who was a weapons officer on one of the Trident nuclear submarines.
Mm-hmm.
Who told his commanding officer that he was getting a divorce and was given a temporary leave of absence because they say, you know, you're under a great deal of mental stress while this is happening, you know, after you've not a leave of absence from the Navy, but just from that role.
Right.
And then, you know, when we reassess that you're in a better place, we, you know, put you back at your job again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they treat this stuff incredibly seriously now.
Yeah.
But in a film that is quite absurd, the way that Ripper's psychosis is treated very seriously, very straight. It's never really made fun of, I don't think.
He
gets a lot of close-up shots with very strong lighting to give you a kind of dramatic effect for it, but it's not.
But I think the nature of his obsession with bodily fluids is, you know, how it manifests is utterly ridiculous and presumably meant to be funny.
No, I don't think it is.
Okay.
I think it's supposed to be ridiculous, but it can be ridiculous and scary rather than ridiculous and funny.
No, I just think that the actual nature of it, with the all of the stuff about the fluids and everybody keeping on talking about bodily fluids, is just puerile.
No, I don't think it is.
Okay.
I mean, yes, you can look at it from that point of view, certainly, but I think the way that pretty much all the stuff on the military base until you get to Mandrake trying to make the phone call, I think everything up to that point you could almost treat as a straight drama.
Yeah.
While all this other completely absurd That's stuff fair. Is going on around it. But other than that,
you've also got Dr. Strangelove is in a wheelchair, but that is very much played for laughs.
That is played for laughs, yes. Yeah. Totally. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much stuff about that character that's deeply wrong.
Yes.
But it's still very...
Everything about him is deeply wrong.
It's still very, very funny.
Okay. Well, as I say, I wish I found more things funny, because then I would find more things funny.
Well, there is that.
And life would be more enjoyable. I do not take pleasure in...
Not taking pleasure?
Denigrating comedy.
Okay.
No, I do not take pleasure in not taking pleasure. It makes me sad.
No. Oh. On which note, are you done?
I think so. Can we be done?
Which case, that wraps up this month's discussion. Regular listeners will know we have ratings that use a 5-star scale with half stars allowed. What do you give it?
I haven't prepared this. I think I'm gonna up it after our discussion, because you've made some interesting points and you have actually made me think about things that I liked about it. I'm gonna up it to 2.
Okay.
How about you?
Yeah, I don't know whether to give it 4.
What?
Or 4.5.
What? Oh. Okay.
I think 4.
Okay. So you still loved it then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very... It's surprisingly punchy. It's just a scratch over 1.5 hours.
Yeah, it was very short.
And, you know, you could argue that it's almost like a number of short, almost like stand-up comedy skits sewn together. The bit where the president talks to the Russian president, the bit where, you know, Mandrake's trying to persuade Ripper not to give him the code, the bit where, you know, Slim Pickens falls into the thing. Those are all little, like, vignettes of stuff that are sewn together, but each one of them is so incredibly well done that, it's just great.
Next month, we are taking a break from responsibility, so if we don't like the thing that is being picked, it's going to be someone else's fault.
Woohoo!
Yeah, so we trailed this a few episodes ago, and it didn't work out, but we are now actually going to have our local pub Quizmaster Jack
Woohoo!
Doing black sales.
Oh, yes. Excellent.
Yeah.
Very much look forward to that.
Indeed. And that's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments or you'd like to tell us about some media that you love and whether or not you still loved it after you shared it with somebody you know, you can always email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com.
You can also buy our merch at bit.ly/loveittomorrowpodcast with hyphens where the spaces should be.
And brand new for this episode, we have curated a Spotify playlist with a song that represents almost all of the episodes that we've done so far. Now, I'm terribly sorry about this URL, but
Will You Still Love It Tomorrow playlist on Spotify. I'm sure you'd be able to find it.
Maybe Spotify search is not great. Okay. I shall read this URL out for you. It's
really?
It's spotty, SPOTI .fi /4BEUYX t. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Right.
I can put a link in the show notes.
Hey, excellent.
So, yes, join us next month to find out what both of us think of Black Sails with Quizmaster Jack.
Quizmaster Jack. Excellent.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.